Hi, I'm Father Roderick, and this show is coming from Spain. From the Simpsons to the sacraments, from technology to theology, this show features the cool and the classical, the past and the future, the trends and the tradition. And today it features a lot of vacation adventures that I want to share with you. Welcome to the show. This episode is brought to you advertisement free without any blabbering about mattresses you should buy or ready to prepare meals services that you can order. Thanks to my patrons. They help me produce these shows with their monthly donations. In addition, they get access to an exclusive podcast feed that only patrons can listen to. And of course, they make it possible for me to finance this work and to do this. What they didn't finance was my vacation, because I financed that myself. But I do want to share some of my adventures here in Spain with you. In case you've missed my other show, The Walk, in the latest episode, I'll already tell you about the week before my vacation, during which I went on a summer camp with a bunch of teenagers in the southern part of Germany. So if you want to hear more about that experience, then I want to refer you to tridio.com and just look for the latest episode of The Walk. Today I want to talk about, well, what's been happening clearly during the night. I'm standing at the foot of the hill on which we have our summer home, and the hill itself is still way above sea level. The sea is in the distance if I turn around. I can just see it between the trees, and there's a big mountain range here on my left. But here, at the foot of the hill, right next to the path that leads up to our summer home, I can tell that there have been wild boars trying to find food, because the ground here has been moved. And yesterday I didn't see all these footprints. And that jives with what Father Harry was telling me yesterday evening. They were hearing these strange sounds, and at one point, a mother boar, a huge, really massive boar, appeared in a small open space here that you could just see from the balcony. And she had also at least one, how'd you call that? Like a baby boar? Like her children were also with her. And I'm actually very glad that they only rummage around here at night, because this is definitely not a bunch of creatures you want to encounter during a walk. Although, of course, I'm walking here outside. Anything can happen. But it's just one of those great aspects of this vacation that will last about 12 days. So I arrived here last Sunday evening. Actually, went to Valencia, and then the next day traveled to this part. I don't even know what it's called. Benicassim is the beach town that from here you can see in the distance. It's a really ugly, touristy place with just basically lots of tall buildings where mostly Spaniards will spend their summer holidays near the beach. And but we're way above all that in this area, which is a reserve, a natural reserve. And it's wonderful. Well, you can probably also hear the crickets and everything, the wind in the trees. The view here is beautiful. This morning we climbed up the mountain range that I see here on my left, and we've been looking at that one mountaintop on the right side. And we never thought that we would be one day, we would be climbing all the way up to that bunch of rocks over there. And I stood right on top of that left outcropping of the rocks. Absolutely stunning experience. Fortunately, we did have some company from the people that borrowed us their vacation home. This actually belonged to their grandmother, but she is now 82 years old. We met her at Mass on Sunday morning. And she said that she was super excited that four priests were now blessing her house with their presence, celebrating Mass on the balcony. And but she was too old to climb all those stairs. And it is there's a lot of climbing involved in order to get to the floors of the house. But she was really thankful to us that we wanted to stay in her house for the duration of our vacation. And so the family, the younger part of the family, came over this morning, and I think it was around 8 o'clock we climbed to that top. And it's mostly what we've been doing for these past 10 days now. In the morning, we go on a hike or we visit a town, and then we eat somewhere, and then it's time for the siesta, which in Spain, because of the high temperatures during the summertime, lasts forever. And it is, everything closes, even churches and museums, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, or they usually eat around 2, even 2:30, which is very late for Northern European standards. And then they will close everything down, and it'll only open up at 5:30, and then people will be in the streets outside until midnight, and that's around the time that temperatures start cooling down. Although we are in the last part of the summer, so fortunately, thankfully, the temperatures are not as hot as they were 2 weeks ago. So in this show, I just want to give you an overview of the things that I've been doing, and at the same time, there's a little kitten. Hey buddy. This little gray kitten that is now sniffing at my phone, and then continues to ignore me, like most cats do. There are a lot of cats in the area. I'm not sure that they even belong to the people that live here in these few houses that you have on this part of the hill. But we did get the advice to bring in all the chairs, because otherwise the next morning you may have discovered that they were used by the cats, the many cats here, as toilet seats. So I want to give you an overview of the things that we've done so far, and kind of in between the various stories, I will also talk about the usual ingredients of my regular show, you know, movies and video games and books and whatnot. So I arrived right after the summer camp. So during the summer camp in Germany, I'd already lived with almost nothing. The theme of the week was back to basic, and I thought, well, let's do exactly what the theme says I should do. And so I took like a minimum of things, just basically the same. Well, it was kind of half of what I took with me when I went to Santiago. So it's just a pair of sandals, a pair of sports shoes or running shoes, two pairs of socks, two pairs of underwear, two shirts. Like I've now got these two Nike, these black Nike shirts, which are made of a certain material that it's got a super dry material. So even if you sweat, which I normally don't do that much anyway, but it will get rid of the humidity right away. So they're very light, extremely easy to wash, and they last forever. So that's what I have. Then I have one, it's not even a pullover, but something warm for the evenings when the temperature will go down. And that's about it. I've got a hat. I've a black baseball hat, which I'm wearing right now with some sunglasses to protect me from the heat. It's I'm recording this. What time is it? It's about 5:30, but the sun is still extremely warm. And I'm walking down this path. This is a private road. And all around me, I can hear these crickets, and they're extremely loud. It's very funny. They all start this sound at a certain time of the day, and then they will all finish at the same moment, almost as if it, I don't know if it's the sun or something like that, but all of a sudden it's like silence. The only thing that I miss here is the sound of birds. I have not heard a single bird here. I've not seen a single bird, and that may be because everything is so dry here. Here on my left are some nut trees. And I'm not sure what kind of nuts these are. I wonder if they're walnuts or something else. But the fruits have burst open, and so you can already see the interior, which is the nut itself. That, of course, still needs to be roasted, I guess, to be edible. And there's the occasional olive tree, but this is, I'm not sure if anyone owns this patch of of ground. So I'm walking down this path, and then I'm going to take one of the more rockier, more adventurous roads that I don't know where that will lead me. What I hope to see is some of those shelters that were built by the Carmelite monks that lived here for many centuries. There was a Carmelite monastery. Actually, we concelebrated Mass there on Sunday morning. They have their novitiate here for the entire country. So we're still quite a few younger brothers and priests living there. But for centuries, the Carmelites have lived here in the mountains as hermits. And they would build these stone half-domed chapels and sometimes a very small apartment. They actually still have one of those apartments on the premises of the monastery. And basically four rooms, one chapel, one room with a bed, one, let's say, hallway, small area, and then a place where they could sit and read and study. Extremely small. And they have one opening in the center. It's just very funny. It's like, it's basically four squares in a bigger square. And then in the center, there's an opening, and they put one candle in the center, and that one candle can light the four rooms, which is quite genius as a solution. Almost sounds like something that a medieval Steve Jobs could have invented. But some of these buildings are still scattered on the mountainsides, and so every once in a while you'll stumble upon one of them. We'll see. So I traveled very light. Striking contrast experiences that I had was that Father Henry gave me a phone call right before we would leave, because we took the same flight, and then Father Michel, coming from Luxembourg, took another one, and Father Harry also took another flight, and arrived a day later. But Father Henry called me up and he said, "Do you still have space in your luggage? Because I have too much." And I said, "How much do you have?" He said, "I have a suitcase and it's more than 20 kilograms. I'm like, "Whoa, 20 kilograms. What do you take with you?" "Oh, some books and some clothes." "And how many clothes?" "Well, just, I don't want to iron my shirt, so I just take one for every day." Like, "Whoa." And I still have a present to give to the family that borrowed us their home, and but it's too heavy for my bag. So I told him I had only taken carry-on luggage. And so the carry-on luggage is 5 kilograms maximum, and I had a little more than 3 kilograms. So it's almost nothing, but just a contrast of 20 kilograms, and it's a massive, we put that in the rental car, and it's almost the entire luggage compartment was filled up by that one suitcase. So I guess I have learned something over time to travel light and keep it simple. Of course, it requires me to wash my clothes every day, but I don't find that very annoying. It's just that sometimes when it's raining or very humid, they won't dry very quickly. But all in all, I didn't have any problems with just the minimum amount of stuff that I had with me. Also didn't take any, no iPads. I just took my e-reader because I wanted to do some reading, and my phone. And I've been using my phone mostly for editing, for recording my podcasts, and browsing the internet, although I did have a small problem. Like when I was in Germany, I made a small video every day for the parents of the kids so they could follow our adventures every day. And I edited that in iMovie on the phone. And then I saved it in 720p, so HD, and uploaded that to Facebook. And that robbed me from most of my data for this month. So when I went on the internet, I immediately got a warning that I'd used up more than 80% of my data, and of course you can change that and up the. So I upped it to even more data for next month, but that's still 12 days from now. So I had to be very, very careful and economic with my data use, which is only then that you realize how often you just browse Instagram and you just browse Facebook and check your email. And especially with these autoplay videos, which are very hard to turn off in Instagram, they use up a lot of data. And then, oh my goodness, I discovered the downside of it, of WhatsApp. I've never been a fan of WhatsApp, which is one of the most popular instant messaging programs here in the Netherlands. It's owned by Facebook, or it's been bought up by Facebook. And it's very different from Messenger. Facebook Messenger, for a lot of the younger kids, they associate that too much with Facebook. And Facebook is regarded, I noticed that also among the teens in the camp, during the summer camp, Facebook is for old people. It's not for them. They're all on Instagram or Snapchat. Mostly Instagram. It's moving slightly, slowly but steadily towards Snapchat, Instagram. I'm moving, by the way, this is where the rougher path begins, where we will soon start to climb down this hill. So it may get a little bit more challenging. Anyway, they're just checking Instagram, and it uses up 100 megabytes in half an hour. So I bought a little bit of extra data. That's how I can upload these shows for you. And, well, those are small expenses, of course. So we arrived in Valencia in the evening, and it was so hot and extremely humid. It was almost when we left the airport, the air conditioning of the airport. Oh, it was like a wet blanket, wet hot blanket was wrapped around us. And again, I was super happy not to have much luggage. Father Henry was carrying all that around. We got a rental car, red Skoda. They really love red cars here in Spain. I guess it's got something to do with their bullfights or something like that. But I'm walking down this gravelly path here. Red stones and rocks. And I've been here once before. I tried to get to the beach, but that's still an hour away. What I want to try to do is to go to the left at one point, because I know that there is another road as soon as I pass the mountain here on my left, the mountain that we climbed this morning. So we arrived in Valencia, and of course we checked into a hotel, which was really nice in the center of the city. And we then got tapas, which I really like. It's all these small, it's kind of finger food in a way. A lot of it is fried. You've got a lot of fish in this area, because Valencia is of course close to the sea. So fish is rather cheap, and on a, when you traveled for, it was just at the end of a long day. Now I've got the masses in the morning. I pack my bags. There's always so much that I have to think of when I go on a trip. And this was, I only had one night at home after the summer camp, so I was really hungry and thirsty because of the heat. So you get this big jug of beer. By the way, so funny. The most of the beer that we saw here is Dutch, and or at least that's what I thought. It's Amstel, which is from, named after the river, the Amstel, which is the river that flows through Amsterdam. That's where Amsterdam got its name from. It's a dam against the Amstel. And then they've got Heineken, of course, which is more of an export beer. But then later on I asked the family here, so what is this? Why do you drink Dutch beer? You've got, you know, San Miguel and other brands in Spain. And then he told me that Amstel is actually regarded by most Spaniards as a local beer, because it's bottled and made right here in this area, I think. Ooh, that's a nice butterfly. Oh, I love these butterflies are all over the place. Like this morning when we were on top of the mountain, there was this beautiful orange pair of butterflies that were flying around my head. Almost felt like Bilbo Baggins in the first Hobbit movie, when he climbs that tree and sticks his head out of the tree, and then he's surrounded by all these beautiful butterflies. That's how it felt on the mountain a little bit. Of course, less butterflies, because no CGI. But It's amazing to see. All the butterflies are already gone in the Netherlands, but here there are plenty of them. I got to be careful here with these rocks because they're slippery. And I actually, only thing I regret is not having taken my mountain shoes or my walking, my strong boots, you know, because these running shoes are nice, but they don't give you much grip on the loose floors here. Anyway, we'll see. And so the next morning we walked around a little bit in Valencia. It's really nice. I used a lot of the, I was amazed by a feature of Google Maps. Now, I usually use Google Maps as my navigation tool. I really love it because it's super up to date. It warns you when there are traffic jams, it reroutes you if necessary. And it's extremely detailed. And you can click on something, you can also put your own pointers on the map, which makes it really easy to find back your car, for instance. But what it also does is, if you type in, for instance, restaurants, it will give you a list of recommended restaurants, and this is based on user reviews, of course. And it will show you the ones that are closest and the ones that get the best ratings. And so when we were in Valencia, and of course there are many, many restaurants there, I just typed in restaurants and I get this list and I read a few reviews. And it's like, whoa, we gotta go there. And it happened to be an Italian restaurant, but the reviews were incredibly good. And apparently from the reviews, it was a very cheap restaurant. So Henry and I got our lunch there and I was blown away. I told the cook at the counter, I'm not sure if it was the cook, but the guy who served us the food, I said, this Italian food is better than in Italy. I'm not kidding you. It was superb. And it's worth going back to Valencia just to eat there. And we've repeated this many times. Whenever we were visiting a small town, we would just look at Google Maps and it would always bring me to the best restaurants. Only downside was that here in Spain, a lot of the restaurants are closed for the summer holidays. So that was a bit annoying. And there was this small restaurant where we wanted to eat paella. And the lady saw us coming at 1 o'clock, which is very early. And she was like, "You guys want to eat?" She's like half surprised. And she just opened the restaurants. Yeah, sure. And you want to eat paella? And she said, "Oh, I cannot do paella right now. So how much time will it take?" "Well, at least an hour. I can't make a decent paella this early in the day." And she was like, "What are you guys doing here?" So instead we went to another restaurant in the Benicassim, which is the beach town. And that restaurant was a stunning food. I took a lot of Instagram photos. If you follow me on Instagram, you may have seen the occasional compilation of the food that we ate. Now, not every photo is from food on my plate, because we always try to diversify. And so sometimes Father Michel or Father Henry will try something different. But most of the food was outstanding and extremely beautiful as well, very colorful. The Spain, I knew this from my Camino, is a very colorful country, and the same is true for the food. So we then went to the summer house that same day, picked up Father Michel, Father Harry from the airport, and the summer house is about an hour away from the city, and that's where we've been staying. It's a really beautiful house with a balcony, and I was a bit wary. If you heard my shows last year about our summer home in France and the kind of disastrous situation that we were in, that the house was swarming with insects and just very, very dirty and strange, and in the middle of nowhere there was nothing in the area. Well, this house was, you know, it was going to be a surprise, but it was a very pleasant surprise. And it's so relaxing in the morning. Right now, for instance, I'm taking this walk, but Father Henry, Father Michel, and Father Harry are just sitting on the balcony in their chairs reading books. Funny habits, by the way. If I go on vacation, I want to mostly entertain myself with Father Harry, who is also a theology teacher at the seminary in the south of the country. He's reading theology. And so in the evening, at 11 o'clock at night, we have these theological discussions about about salvation and about grace. He's currently reading a book about I'm not sure how you call it, the theology of grace. And it's very, very interesting discussions. And this morning we had a big discussion about exegesis, so the study of biblical texts, and we exchanged our experiences. And Father Michel is always reading books about sailing, because he loves sailing, and so he's always reading some kind of adventure book with pirates and sailboats. Father Henry is finally reading The Name of the Rose, which is a book that the group of students that he lived with in seminary gave him when he left the seminary 25 years ago. He never read it. And so he has now almost finished Umberto Eco's masterpiece. And so it seems to be very entertaining. I'm reading a ton of books without finishing any of them, which is also very typical, because there's always something else I want to do. And I like to cook, I like to go out for walks, record podcasts. But I want to give you one review of a book that is the book that I've read the most of during this vacation. And it's called Sapiens. This was on top of the bestseller lists last year. It's written by an historian, Yuval Noah Harari. I'm not sure where he's from. But the book was first mentioned to me by my editor. And he said, you got to read this book. It's amazing. It's like this historian, and he takes you on this whirlwind tour of history. Starts in 70,000 BC with the Neanderthals and the Homo erectus and the Homo sapiens and all these different types of, different species of humans. And I never realized that. And so I started reading, and then actually the author goes through history, through 70,000 years of human history, but always from a top view, describing the events, but also trying to distillate, let's say, common characteristics of mankind that don't change, and certain behaviors that are kind of part of the species of the Homo sapiens. And there's a lot of food for thought in there. And I'm not very knowledgeable in biology or in archaeology or in history, but it's a riveting read. And one of the most interesting things in the first part of the book is that he analyzes the emergence of the Homo sapiens as the dominant form of man. And then, of course, that there is this mysterious disappearance of, for instance, the Neanderthals that lived in the north, in the European parts of the world. Neanderthals were much stronger than the Homo sapiens, that lived more in Africa, in Eastern Africa. And then you had the Homo erectus in Asia, much smaller in size. And then there's another kind that has been discovered not so long ago. And so there's this whole question of why did the other species... And this is kind of, I also didn't realize that. You've got this linear thinking that there's Homo sapiens has always been the one and only, you know, form of mankind. And then, but it's actually like the panther. You know, the panther is a genus in Latin. And then you've got the species. You've got different types of the same genus. So a panther can be a tiger, can be a panther, pantera. It can be a cat. And so, wait a minute, I hope I didn't miss that one road that goes to the left, because I've been chatting around, but I'm not paying much attention to my surroundings, other than the rocks beneath my feet, which always require a lot of focus. So, and that was the same for mankind. And so the question, he asks a question, what would the world look like if these other species of mankind had also survived? And you would have Neanderthals, and of course they have common ancestry, just like with the panther. There is a common, let's say, a pair of parents, and then usually it's because of the circumstances and the the geographical circumstances and location where these different, where these animals lived, and then that would ultimately lead to genetic changes, adaptations basically to the surroundings. That's why, for instance, Neanderthals were much stronger and sturdier and could resist the colder climate much better than the sapiens and the erectus. But at one point there starts to emerge incompatibility between these species. And so it's like the horse and the mule, I should say the horse and the donkey, they can pair if they're forced to. They don't do that naturally, but the mule that resorts from that is sterile. And so that is probably something that happened with other animal categories as well, and perhaps also with mankind. But then, according to the book, they did some genetic research in 2010, and they discovered that, at least in Homo sapiens and in Europe, there was a certain percentage that was Neanderthal. And it's unique DNA that has to come from the Neanderthal branch of humans. And it's just fascinating. So what happened? And so one of the theories, and the book has a lot of theories, and so it's you know, it's debatable, and there's been, I'm not sure controversy, but definitely debate about some of the premises of the book or the theories. But that's the interesting aspect of the book. So according to the writer, one of the characteristics of the Homo sapiens is that it's a very destructive race, and so he doesn't exclude massive genocide to get rid of the Neanderthals, and it's something that he also connects to religion. So he describes the emergence of religion, and of course this is from a kind of sociological, biological perspective. It is definitely not a philosophical or religious perspective in his writing. He says there is, the religion often becomes something that unites people throughout history, but also separates them from people that don't share those ideas, and that becomes a means to separate we and they, and leads to extermination of the other party and to massive wars. And this is a pattern that repeats itself over and over. Now, as someone who does believe that there's more to religion than that, I still think it is an interesting thought that this is kind of part of how human societies kind of work. But I would always say that's just kind of the disposition of mankind. But we also have morals, we have ethics, we have a brain, we have a compass that is called conscience, and we have religion that oftentimes will tell us to act almost against our instincts. And a lot of the debate nowadays about the negative role of religion, and this is rampant everywhere in public opinion, is that religion only leads to more division and more hatred between groups of people. And if you would, you know, it's kind of the John Lennon simplification, if you would just abolish religion and everybody would be friends. And I think that this regards that a lot of religions, and especially the Christian religion, calls for a change of attitude where you sacrifice yourself for your neighbor, even if that neighbor ultimately can be your enemy. Like, one of the most important aspects of the sacrifice of Jesus is that he gives his life for the sinners, for the people that were against him, for the people that put him on the cross, and not just for the good guys. And so there's this selflessness and this ability to love even against your natural instincts, and to give your life for others instead of only thinking about yourself. And so there's this kind of disposition, but it doesn't really imprison us. It is something that will come back every time, and it's like an urge or like an instinct, but at the same time it's not I don't like the determinism that you often hear in these simplifications, that, you know, we just look for excuses everywhere to kill each other. It's a very negative worldview and a negative anthropological view of what we are and what we are able to do. And I think love and sacrifice is just as much part of mankind's history than as is destruction and hatred and mass murder. So anyway, it's a very thought-provoking book. There is a sequel to it that I also bought at the Kindle store. I bought these when they were on sale. And it's called, I think, Homo Deus, which is more about the future. And an overall recommendation. It's a very riveting read and very thought-provoking. And not really summer vacation literature, but it's written so well that it reads almost like an adventure book. The Adventure of Mankind. So let's switch to food. Already talked a little bit about our discoveries of the haute cuisine in all these towns in Spain. But this Sunday, we had the incredible fortune of receiving the family, and the lady of the house actually made us a paella, a real traditional regional paella. And I always thought that paella was made with seafood and fish. Well, it turns out that the original paella here in this part of Spain was not made with seafood. That was used in most of the coastal areas. But as soon as you go more inwards in the country, you couldn't keep the seafood from spoiling. There was no cooling at the time, so the original form of paella here, whoa, that was almost slipped and fell. The original paella here was made with rabbit and chicken. And so she made us a traditional paella at home. And it was the first time during this vacation that I actually switched from keto back to carb, because of the rice, of course. And I didn't want to offend them. Plus, I was very curious about the taste. But I was amazed how simple it was here in Spain to stay completely keto. Didn't eat usually in the morning, because I wasn't hungry. So it's the intermittent fasting. Then at noon, oftentimes I would just order. We usually eat in a restaurant at noon. I'd order meat and legumes or salad, but not nothing with carbs. So no rice, no potatoes, and that worked out really well. So I would be very surprised if I'd gained weight this vacation. And that was not the only reason that I don't think that I'm gaining weight, which was always the case during previous vacations. I would always gain a few pounds because of all the food, and you don't want to count calories when you're on vacation. But I also did a lot of running. I'm very proud of myself. I'm training for that marathon in Amsterdam in October. And the only exception was during the week in Germany. I just couldn't find the time to go out on training runs because I had to be with the group, at least 16 hours a day. So there's just absolutely no way that I could go out for a run. Plus, we were in the hills, so there was just no flat surface here. I did run in the mountains, which was extremely strenuous. So I went for a run the first day here. And I was actually running here on this path that I'm currently walking on. I was running that all the way to the beach and then up again over. But I took the road for the cars on the way up because this is pretty hard to climb up, which, by the way, makes me realize that I still have to go all the way up after recording this. The extra amount of effort. You don't go very fast when you're going down a hill like this. And then I saw that near the beach everything was flat. So this past Sunday, I had one of my bigger training runs that was required, one of the longest distance actually since I started the training, and that was 20 miles, which is 32 kilometers. That's a lot, even in the Netherlands on a flat surface. So on Sunday morning, I woke up at 6. I took the car to the beach. And then I ran north all the way to the Salt Tower, which is there are a lot of towers here near the beach that were used to warn against pirates. So every once in a while, pirates would invade the countryside and they would light fires in those towers. And so there is I think it's a salt deposit up north. It also has one of those stone towers from the late Middle Ages, I think. And when I looked on the map, I was like, oh, I can't believe I did all that. But it was beautiful because as soon as you're out of the city and you leave the hotels behind, you have this very quiet, beautiful, it's not really a beach, but it's this natural seaside. And I saw the sunrise over the sea, which is something I barely ever witness, because in the Netherlands the sea is in the west, so you only see sunsets, never sunrises over the water. So that was gorgeous. And then I was really amazed that they had carved out these huge tunnels through the mountains, through the rocks. And whereas the path that I was following was used by bikers, there are a lot of people that ride their bikes, even that early in the morning, the runners, and just general tourists. I was like, whoa, they really invest in their tourism. Well, it turns out that the road on which I was running used to be an old train track, and it has a small train that would go north from the two cities in the south. And just recently, I think in the 80s, they moved to a much faster train track, faster equipment, and then they transformed this old train track into a path for bikers. So, but the advantage was it just went on and on and on and on. And then I came to this other city that the family explained that they built that city almost illegally. There were a lot of people that were building these big tourist apartments near the sea without permit. And then the government was a bit, you know, like, what can we do? And this should be forbidden. But then other people did get their licenses and started building around those illegal buildings. And before you knew it, they had created this massive town, which is north from Benicassim. And it's ugly. It looks like a very cheap, poor man's version of Las Vegas. So every hotel has these garish colors and LED advertisements. And it's got these Irish bars, and there was one bar that was called Irish Door, so the golden Irishman. But then they, like, that doesn't make sense. You're in Spain and you use like an English word and a French word. What? And it was just casinos and everything, and everywhere when I was running there, there's just people waking up, and then you've got these massive people. It was massive in size, and they're walking around, especially the man with these huge bellies, just wearing this tiny little black piece of underwear and then slippers. And it's just like, oh God, I don't know if I want to see this. It's just, and then a lot of these huge people were walking around, tiny little dogs. It was like, man, I feel like I'm in a cartoon or in WALL-E, you know? It's strangely decadent, everything. So I was really glad that after a while I could leave that behind as well. And I was in the countryside and I was among the fruit trees, and I saw plenty of what was it? The prunes, and they had oranges, of course. What's this fruit? This red fruit. If you open it, it's got this nice, really juicy interior. Figs, everything. So that was really nice. But of course I didn't have any breakfast before I left, so came back really hungry and craving fruit. So fortunately that day I decided to switch from keto to carbs so I could eat a lot of fruit. So the running went well, keto went well. I think I may have lost another few pounds here. Oh, I'm now on the lower part. I think I've left the mountain behind. Turn around and I see the way that I have to climb up again. Oh, so far. And in front of me I can see a road, which is, I think, where the path to the left will lead me. So I'm gonna try to get there, although I'm not sure if I should follow that path because I've already been climbing for about 45 minutes now. Oh well. It's getting a little bit rocky here. So then early in the beginning of our vacation, we wanted to discover a few towns. And one of the towns that we saw had a small castle. There's not much special in the area, but we figured, you know, it's an old castle, maybe interesting. We didn't expect much. It was a tiny village. But we arrive there and park our cars, and then we hear music. We hear a band in the distance, and it's this fantastic Spanish music, you know. I love the Spanish fanfare music. And so my initial thought was, oh, party, you know, village party, village feast. And that was what it was. They were preparing a procession with these ladies in mantillas and traditional garb, and followed by men with an entire orchestra walking in the streets. And then the quality of the music was awesome. Filmed a lot of it. But then we saw these cages all over the town. So the entire center of the town was lined with cages in bright colors, blue and red and yellow. And some of the cages were stacked upon each other. There were seats on top of them. And so that's when we... Oops. My microphone is stuck in the bushes. Sorry about that, guys. I have to untangle this. That's the danger of walking around in nature. And I have to fix my microphone because even the windshield detached itself. Hold on, I hope you can still hear me more or less. I'm gonna put the phone on the ground here. Do some improvisation because I'm recording this with the the Voice Memo app of Apple, and I don't think it has a pause button. So I'm just gonna push this back in. Hopefully that didn't blow out your ears. I'm gonna attach this to my shirt again, and we're up and running again. Well, not running, but... So anyway, turned out there was a big bullfight planned in the center of the city. There's this square that looked like an arena, and people were actually entering these cages. And so we were waiting there and getting some finger food, and then all of a sudden we heard people running, and that's when the bulls arrived. And there were a couple of young bulls and some bigger ones that they were chasing down the streets into the arena. And then in the arena itself, they went behind a fence so they could introduce them later on in the arena. Now, at first, I was very hesitant. I was like, I don't know if I want to see this. I don't want to promote this. I don't like traditional bullfighting in Spain. I think it's extremely cruel, unnecessary suffering for the animals. But then we heard an announcement over the speakers saying that actually this bullfight was going to be verified controlled by the Animal Protection Agency, and that the animals would not be harmed. And that's exactly what happened. We saw that it wasn't really a bullfight. It was just a bunch of young guys in blue t-shirts, and they were running around the arena teasing the young bull, and the bull was just not even that interested. But sometimes he would charge and run after one of these guys, and they would jump over stuff and then get behind the safety bars. And that was basically it. And so the applause was for if they did like a cunning escape, like the very last second. But the bull itself, you know, stayed rather calm. And actually, they didn't even touch the bull. They had these small rubber bands that they were trying to get put on the horns of the bull. And that was basically how they would score points. And I was watching this, like, that is such a good way to turn something that is in itself very cruel and unfriendly to animals into a different tradition, to kind of transform the tradition in something that's much more harmless for the animal and also for the people involved, and still kind of honors that tradition of running around being chased by bulls. In the meantime, I've arrived here at the little chapel that I was hoping I would find again. And it's on my left is the dome, the half dome, that looks very much like the monasteries that you saw in The Last Jedi. So this is exactly the same type of building where Luke Skywalker lives. It's got a door here. There's a cross on top of it. in stone. The only difference with what you saw in The Last Jedi was that there, those half domes were made out of gray rock. Here it's all red. It's a red-brown rock. And attached to this half dome here on the left, the Jedi Jedi home, there is actually a wall with a beautiful arched entry or porch way, which I will first walk through. And I think that this was probably the home of, yes, this is exactly it. This is where the monk or the hermit would live. And now it's overgrown. There are trees and there's bushes, so I can't really walk inside the home. There's no roof, obviously. But I think that there's another exit here, which I can walk through. Let me see. I think this is actually the side of the house. Let me turn around. Oh, no, wait a minute. Whoa, this is much bigger than I thought. There is another much bigger room here. But wait a minute. This is much bigger than I thought. So this is a massive... This could... Oh, I know what this is. This wasn't a room. This was probably an inner garden, because there are walls around it, but the rest of the building is too... The walls are too low for a roof. You couldn't stand in this. So I think this was a garden, and then probably this wall that has an opening in it, which I'm going to climb through. This was the outer wall of the garden. Oh, no, wait a minute. No. There is more. This is probably... What would this be? I wonder if they were using this for animals. Because here on my left, or on my in front of me and on my right, are even more archways. And there's another wall. I climb underneath. It's very small. There's a big wall. And this, I think, is the outer perimeter of the building. And I can tell the wall in front of me is much taller, so the roof probably would lead the water, the rain, to the center. And I wouldn't be surprised if this was were a garden or kept for, or where animals would be kept to protect them against the wild animals in this area. Or perhaps, who knows, against pirates and and criminals. So I'm going to go back to the chapel. I had no idea. Last time I was here, I only saw the chapel and the wall. I figured that was it. But this is so big that it may have actually harbored several hermits that perhaps lived around this inner courtyard or something like that. I need to look this up. So let me go inside that Jedi house, because this is so cool. It really, really... The only thing it lacks is the wing of the X-Wing that Luke Skywalker used as a door. You can just walk inside. And it's pretty dark in here. It's surprisingly cool. The walls of this half-dome are very thick. There's a tiny little opening in the rooftop. Or actually two openings, and I think that was probably used in the wintertime, because some of the stone over there is also blackened, so I think that what they would do is make a fire here in the winter time to heat up the space, because it can get very cold here in the winter. And there are a few alcoves here, a few openings. This definitely has been an altar. I'm absolutely certain it's a big rectangular opening. It's got a little bit, they tried to create an arched top part of this, and so this is about the height of an altar. So this is probably where they would celebrate mass. And then there is a very tiny opening here in the walls. Perhaps this is where they would put the chalice, or I don't know, the whatever they needed to celebrate mass. And here's another slightly bigger opening, but it's never been a window. There's one window here near the exit, on the right side, and it's partially blocked by stones now, but I think the originally was slightly bigger, and that would lead in some light and some air. And I wouldn't be surprised if there has been a door, or at least a wooden door or something like that, because there's an opening here that may have been for a mechanism so you could open and close the door. So the window makes sense to leave to get in air, especially in the winter when you're burning fire there. But really, really makes me feel like a Jedi. Speaking of, well, a Jedi, a Jedi apprentice. Who are you? I don't know. I've dreamt about this place, and somehow I always knew I had to be here. This morning I had a conversation with one of the family members that accompanied us to the top. By the way, I'm turning around now. I'm going to climb up again, because I'm not sure if it's wise to continue. It's already 6:30, and I guess the guys want to still play Risk, which is what we've been doing every vacation. And so I don't want to leave them waiting for too long. Plus, it will take me another hour to go up again. But one of those family members, we hadn't met them yet, but it was a cousin of one of the others. And we talked about Star Wars the other day, and what's his name? Damien or something like that. He said that he'd seen my trailer reaction to the trailer for Episode 7. And he had alerted his cousin, who is also a huge Star Wars fanatic, and I think that he came along with us especially because he wanted to talk Star Wars with me. So while we were climbing, it was a pretty perilous hike, really, where you had to use hands and feet to get to the higher parts of the mountain. Careful, this is the part where I lost my microphone. While we were climbing, we were talking about Star Wars and about the prequels, and he's a very young kid. I think he's in his 20s. And so I asked him, what did you like? Did you like The Last Jedi? He was like, yeah, I don't know. And he didn't really care that much for Episode 7 either, but he loved the prequels. I was like, what? Really? Yeah, he said, I liked that. I was really... The prequels had much better villains and Darth Maul, and then you had Palpatine, and there was this... There was more drama, and there were so many different locations and different fights, and then he said, well, Episode 7 was basically a rehash of blowing up the Death Star, and it was just... There are no good villains in the new Star Wars movies, according to him. It's just Kylo Ren, who's not really truly a villain. He's more conflicted. Well, I kind of have to agree with that. And then the only other villain is, of course, Snoke. And Snoke is disposed of so quickly. And we barely get to see how evil he is and how dangerous. So it's like that the prequels were much better in that. There was real danger and real excitement and adventure. Yeah, I kind of have to give him that. On the other side, on the other hand, I also really like the current movies, as you know. And part of the repetition of the motives and of the themes is part of what makes Star Wars Star Wars. It's always the same kind of stories told in different circumstances. But anyway, he liked Solo, but didn't really love it. Now, the one movie that he wanted to see was a movie about Obi-Wan Kenobi. He said, Obi-Wan Kenobi was the best thing about the prequels. And so I told him that there were rumors, recent rumors, that Disney was developing or had been developing a Tatooine-based movie. And my theory is that that movie would heavily focus on an older Obi-Wan Kenobi. And I think from a storytelling point of view, that would be really interesting to give more background to the story that we already know of Obi-Wan, a crazy old fool, and perhaps Lars and Beru, Aunt Beru, and young Luke Skywalker. You could bring in a younger Luke Skywalker and have Obi-Wan trying to protect him, and so many different... Because it's pretty clear that Luke Skywalker, when he talks about Obi-Wan Kenobi, has met the guy. It's that old man, is it? Do you think it's Ben Kenobi? And so he does know. And so there is actually material to expand that. And I like that. I like it when we get to discover stories that give more depth to the stories that we already know. It's kind of what the prequels also did in a slightly you know, not so successful way, but at least they tried. But I think from a commercial point of view, doing an Obi-Wan Kenobi Tatooine movie right now would be a big mistake and very dangerous, because I think people would immediately compare it to Solo, you know, yet another character that we see the prequel of, and is that, you know, what's new about that? We already know how it will end. So I think in terms of storytelling, I think they could do a good job, but I'm not sure if in terms of marketing they could sell it. And I'm definitely not sure that they will want to take that risk, at least right now. Another movie that I think they should make and would be instantly successful is a standalone movie about Darth Vader. I think that is something that, like, you remember the moment when we see Darth Vader in Rogue One? And you see how powerful he is and how aggressive and, like, wow. Yeah, I want to see more of that. That is, it's kind of the missing part in Anakin's story, is how does he get from, you know, this moment that he gets transformed into Vader and gets all the prosthetic equipment to survive after his fight with Obi-Wan, to, you know, the slightly much older Darth Vader that we see at the beginning of A New Hope. So I think that they could bring back so many classic Star Wars things, elements. And I think people would be very forgiving if it's about Darth Vader. Because who doesn't love Darth Vader? So, whew. Okay, so this is going to climb up a little bit more. So, it was cool to have this little Star Wars discussion on top of a mountain this morning. Definitely much more my kind of hobby than what we've been suffering for a few days here, which was right outside of the natural reserve. There's this big open field, and it's not far from where the Carmelite brothers and priests live, and they organized over the weekend a reggae festival, and it looked like Woodstock. We had to pass by it, by the big parking lot, and it was like the stuff you saw on documentary footage of Woodstock. Is, yeah, tens of thousands of cars and vans, and then just the streets completely run over by Rastafari, you know, all these kids and students and people walking around with this long Rasta hair and red, yellow, green colors with the woven hats and everything. And it looked so out of place in Spain. It's like, that is so weird. In the middle of this very traditional area where many villages still have their bullfights and walk around in traditional garb, and all of a sudden you've got a reggae pop festival. And so a lot of these, when I was going to, when I was driving my car to the parking lot for my 20-mile run on Sunday, they were actually only returning from the last performances of the reggae festival, and so most of them had probably danced and smoked weed during the night, and were now going to the beach to wake up. And I was like, okay, that is probably a type of music that I will never understand. Even as a child, I was pretty omnivorous when it comes to music, but reggae music, that was really not my thing. Although, because I felt it was always kind of the same rhythm, the same, like they all kind of sounded the same, and I didn't understand, I still don't really understand the culture around reggae and what makes it so appealing. So many people here in Spain. Family told us that this is actually an event that came from Italy, and that they moved it over to Spain for some reason. Don't ask why. And we heard it all night long in our rooms, and of course we were sleeping with the windows open, and all night long you hear those reggae rhythms. So I fortunately have my earplugs and sleeping mask, but without it, I'd probably have nightmares about Bob Marley. Anyway, so let's see, what else do I have to share? I'm almost approaching the end of my walk, or at least of my recording here. Let's talk about going home, because that's what's going to happen on Thursday. On Wednesday, I'm going to bring back Father Michel to Valencia. He's leaving for the World Family Days in Ireland, where Pope Francis will also be. And Father Michel, of course, is the author of Tweeting with God, and he's working on another related project, which is really awesome. I'm not sure if I can talk about it, because it's still in development, but I'll let him post that if you follow him on Twitter or on Facebook. But so he's invited to do a talk about the upcoming youth synod, or it's the Episcopal Synod about the youth. So it's bishops thinking about what they should do to help the youth follow Christ. And that's taking place, I think, in September. And so he's doing a talk about that. Pope Francis is going to be there. But, of course, the whole theme of family is overshadowed now by the disastrous news from the Pennsylvania report by the grand jury, which is another huge blow, I think, to the credibility of the church. And it's just unbelievably gruesome what is described there. Oh, there's another someone who's coming with me. Hola. We're walking a little bit faster, so I'm gonna let him pass me. So the sheer size is, this is about, of course, many decades of abuse, but the most shocking aspect of it is, as it was in previous revelations, it's not just the abuse itself, which is horrific enough, but it's the systematic, methodical cover up of that, which seems to, for the first time, have consequences not just for the local church or the reputation of the local people, like bishops and cardinals, that were in a way complacent and with their covering up have perpetuated the abuse and put victims in further danger. But it now also reaches the Vatican, and the cover-up and the trying to minimize the damage, the reputation damage, and perhaps, or probably also the financial damages for the church and for the Vatican. There's more and more coming to light right now that there were people that in the Vatican have also abused their power and their influence to hide this from the public, and potentially also from the Pope and from other responsible. So I think this is, I've said this also in the walk, the last episode of the walk, I think this will have repercussions that we cannot really predict yet, because I really believe that this is only the top of the iceberg. I've said this before, the previous revelations. If this happens in one diocese, we're talking about structural problems, then it is likely, if not certain, that this has taken place in many other places as well, on a worldwide scale, because this is about clericalism. It's about the abuse of power, and it's about the abuse that occurs if a church has too much power and is not held accountable. I think that's what Pope Francis tries to pinpoint when he wrote his recent letter to the world. It's the first time he addresses the world about this problem and mentions the Pennsylvania report by name. And one of the big causes, according to him, is clericalism. It's this position where the church, or of the church, where it no longer serves, but it serves itself, and egotism and cruelty and abuse of power takes over and becomes a satanic force of destruction. And I think this may actually very well last for many more years, if not decades, before this is rooted out. And now we're talking about the United States. We've seen exactly the same patterns and the same structures of evil at work in Europe, in many countries, in my own country, in Belgium. And the same problems persist as well, that those that were clearly and proven perpetrators of this get away with it. Don't get punished, don't get handed over to the authorities, don't end up in jail, but instead end up in a monastery living a life of quiet penance. And I was like, that is not enough. This screams for a much more symbolic punishment or token punishment. You cannot just tell people to live the rest of their lives in penance and prayer. I know that some people would actually really enjoy that. So, and that is also, I think, the disappointing aspect of the Pope's letter, even though it's, I'm pretty sure it's very heartfelt and it's very compassionate, but it lacks any type of practical measure. There's no resolution in there, no plan on how to change this. There's a lot of talk about it. We have to solve this together. It's a common responsibility, not just responsibility of the bishops, etc. But there's nothing specific in there. And I think the reason is probably that they have opted, from a communications point of view, to react swiftly. That's very important. The first thing you need to do is talk, is acknowledging what has happened, and show that it touches you, that it scandalizes you, and you have to express your solidarity and your it's more than solidarity, actually. The Pope explains it well. He says if these victims are members of the church, they are part of the church, and their suffering is our suffering. So that is something that I think they wanted to express, instead of what I think a lot of the perpetrators and the ones that protected them have done, is to distance themselves from it and to try to minimize the perceived effects of what had happened. But this can only be the first step, and it should be followed just as swiftly by more statements and, much more important, by very specific action. And it needs to be radical, because nothing that we've seen so far has helped, let's be honest. And right, there's another, hello, another hiker that's passing me by. So, well, that's not true. I think a lot of the measures that are now in place have actually helped and have minimized or reduced, I'm not sure if it's minimized, but definitely reduced the dangers and have increased the accountability. But it doesn't mean that we won't see more of these revelations, because this has all, you know, been going on for decades. And I think the only way to help the victims is by doing more than just expressing your sorrow and your compassion. It requires a factual determination and a plan to root this out and to bring to light. It's not just rooting it out and diminishing the risks and the dangers. It's also, it is rooting it out. It is bringing to light everything that is still hidden. And unless we do that, it needs to be a purge. And that may actually have historical consequences for the Catholic Church. But it needs to happen, because God can only build on top of true remorse and true confession. That's what I always say when I try to explain the sacrament of confession, of penance. Yes, you can ask in your heart for forgiveness, but when we do that, we often glance over the things we don't, as long as we don't express it and we don't firmly resolve practically to counteract the influence of evil in our lives and to repair the damage that we've done, then there can be no true conversion, and to a certain extent there can be true forgiveness either. And I think that is the case here. Anyway, this is the beginning. It's only the beginning of a very, very long development, I think, in our Western world. Well, it's not just the Western world. I'm pretty convinced that this has happened also in many other countries in the world, in Africa, in Asia, wherever the church is on a pedestal and has too much power. There's going to be this type of behavior, unfortunately. But we should never despair. You should always keep hope. Definitely the people of God has a responsibility to demand accountability and also to raise their voices, even against the Pope if necessary, when the people of God feels that it's not enough. And I think that a lot of us are sick and tired of the excuses and the cover-ups and the half-measures and the words that are not followed by action. So I think the history, church history, has shown us that sometimes a revolt of the lay people and of the church, the kind of a groundswell, is the only way to change things for real. And it's not enough to leave it up to the few people that are actually in charge. We'll see. Okay. So I'm almost there. I'm looking forward to returning to Amersfoort. I love my vacation right now, but it's going to be a really fun fourth quarter. Of course, I've got my TV shows. I've got a lot of plans that I can't really talk about right now because I'm still negotiating. I've been negotiating during my vacation about some aspects of what will happen in the fourth quarter, which was a bit of a deliberate choice. I normally don't like to work when I'm on vacation, and it's true. It's the email inbox is like a TARDIS. You open the door and you're in another world, and it's so much bigger on the inside. And it doesn't end. And all of a sudden you're in a different universe and a different time, and you're no longer in Spain, but you're back at home. But in my case, it is ultimately work that I'm doing to put in place the pieces for what I'm trying to build. And that is something that excites me and that I love to do. But I try to keep it as brief as possible. And I also have to say that I feel different about these kind of things. I used to really resent it when I would get phone calls while I was away or emails that reminded me of home. But I didn't really like the situation that I was in. There was a lot of stress, a lot of... I'm going to wipe the sweat out of my face here for a second, because I put on sunscreen. But now the sweat makes the sunscreen leak into my eyes, which is a little bit blinding. So I put on sunglasses again. But now with Martin at home, he's taking care of stuff. Inge is working on the website and doing. She's continuing her work, so I don't have to worry about that. I can just delegate that, and I know that it's taken good care of, and that changes a lot of things. It also changes my attitude towards whatever, you know, occasional email or phone call will come in. But nevertheless, I'd prefer a vacation where there's none of that. But this is kind of the best I can manage for now. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of my talk. Almost the end of my walk, although that's why I'm trying to encourage myself, because I think I'm only halfway. And it's climbing up a lot, but I'm going to do that without you having to suffer my breathing, my heavy breathing and sweating. I thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode from Spain. And before you know it, I'll be back behind the microphone in Amersfoort. And I will talk about the usual things again once I get back into the movie theaters and and have more, more time to do my usual stuff. But thanks for coming along, and I will see you soon. Thanks to my patrons so much for your help and for your support. It means the world to me. By the way, for those of you that are patrons, stay tuned, because right after I press stop for this recording, I will record an extra episode just for you guys and girls. So thanks, and see you soon on the other side of patreon.com/FatherRoderick. Take care and God bless.